Welcome to the Be Freed podcast, where we distill the world's best sources into personalized insights you can actually use. I'm Naya, joined by my co-host, Jackson. Today, we're diving into something that affects every decision you make, yet most people never notice it.
I'm Jackson, and I'm so excited about today's topic, human behavior's weirdest quirks. We'll explore why you hit snooze 3 times despite promising yourself you wouldn't, why free trials are so effective, and why you can't stop scrolling social media even when you're exhausted.
And the fascinating thing is that these aren't random glitches. They're predictable patterns backed by decades of research from giants like Daniel Kahneman, Dan Ariely, and Robert Cialdini. Ready to discover why your brain is so wonderfully weird?
Let's start with something mind-blowing. Did you know that in some European countries, over 90% of people are organ donors, while in others, it's less than 15%? The countries are culturally similar, so what explains this massive difference?
Cultural values? Religious differences?
That's what you think, but Dan Ariely in his famous TED Talk revealed it comes down to one tiny thing: whether the DMV form was opt-in or opt-out. If the default was check this box to become a donor, few did. If it was check this box to not be a donor, few did that either.
Wait, so the same people who wouldn't check a box to become a donor also wouldn't check a box to avoid becoming one? That's wild.
Exactly. Defaults are incredibly powerful because they signal the normal thing and save us mental effort. Johnson and Goldstein's research in Science showed that opt-out systems could potentially save thousands more lives through increased donation rates.
I'm thinking about all the defaults in my life. Notifications, subscription renewals, what's at eye level in my fridge. I'm guessing most weren't chosen deliberately.
Most weren't. And here's the practical takeaway. Audit your life's defaults. Make the good path the path of least resistance. Put your running shoes by the door, not your TV remote.
Speaking of things we can't stop doing, let's talk about why I sometimes find myself scrolling Instagram at 1 a.m. despite needing to be up at 6.
That's the dopamine economy at work. Neuroscience shows that dopamine neurons don't just respond to rewards, they respond to better than expected rewards. When rewards are variable and uncertain, like maybe the next scroll will show something amazing, that keeps your brain's learning signal active.
Is that why slot machines are so addictive? You never know when you'll hit the jackpot?
Precisely. And social media feeds use the exact same principle. Variable rewards keep you engaged. Dr. Andrew Huberman explains this brilliantly in his Dopamine Masterclass episodes, warning about dopamine stacking, layering multiple hits like music plus caffeine plus social media onto every task.
I definitely do that. I can't fold laundry without a podcast, can't run without music, can't work without coffee.
And that trains your brain to find ordinary life boring. Huberman suggests unstacking pleasures. Separate your coffee from your phone time. Let workouts sometimes be just workouts without entertainment.
That reminds me of what Stanford addiction psychiatrist Anna Lemke calls the pleasure-pain balance. Too much dopamine can tip your system into a deficit state where normal life feels flat.
Naya read in a relatable, casual, empathetic voice, like a best friend who just gets you.
Like how songs grow on you after a few listens?
Exactly. Robert Zion's research showed that mere exposure, even subliminal, boosts likability. It's why brands saturate you with logos and why that coworker you initially found annoying starts to feel trustworthy over time.
And I'm guessing marketers exploit this?
Absolutely. Rory Sutherland, vice chair of Ogilvy, calls this psychologic. Incentives and signals that make emotional, if not rational, sense. On Modern Wisdom podcast, he explained how small signaling tweaks shift behavior far more than actual product features.
So if I'm trying to persuade someone, I should make my message familiar through consistent framing and repetition?
Yes, and pay attention to who delivers the message. Cialdini's research shows that messengers with authority, likability, and social proof carry disproportionate weight.
Let's talk about something I think about constantly. How much people notice my mistakes. Last week, I stumbled over my words in a presentation and was mortified for days.
Classic spotlight effect. Researchers had students wear embarrassing t-shirts to class and then asked them to estimate how many people noticed. The students wildly overestimated. They were anchored on their own vivid experience and forgot that others were lost in their own heads.
That's actually comforting. So my presentation stumble probably wasn't the career-ending disaster I imagined?
Most people probably forgot about it minutes later. This affects us in two ways. We post less or take fewer risks because we miscalculate the social cost, and we over-index on the few comments we do get, confusing a tiny audience sample for what everyone thinks.
So the practical takeaway is to treat work more like a rehearsal than a high-stakes performance?
Exactly. Share drafts, ask for feedback in small groups, and publish more often in smaller chunks. You'll discover people are both kinder and busier than your anxious brain assumes.
Here's a fun experiment. Rate how well you understand how a zipper works on a scale of 1 to 10.
I'd say a 7 or 8. It's pretty simple.
Now try to write out a detailed explanation of the mechanism.
Oh no, I suddenly realize I have no idea how the teeth interlock or disengage. Maybe I'm a 3?
That's the illusion of explanatory depth. Rosenblit and Kyle documented this across devices and phenomena. We think we understand things until we try to explain them, and then our confidence plummets.
This seems especially relevant today with complex issues like AI ethics or climate policy. People have strong opinions, but often can't explain the underlying mechanisms.
Exactly. The practical takeaway is simple but powerful. When a topic gets heated, ask yourself, could I explain the mechanism step by step? If not, set a 5-minute timer and try. It right-sizes your confidence and highlights where you need to learn more.
Let's talk about memory. I've noticed that some experiences that were objectively long and difficult, like a challenging hike, I remember fondly, while shorter, easier experiences sometimes leave a bad taste.
That's the peak and rule. Daniel Kahneman showed that our remembered experience is dominated by two moments, the peak, best or worst, and the end, with almost total duration neglect.
So we don't accurately remember how long things took.
Not at all. In one striking study, people preferred a longer, painful medical procedure with a slightly less painful ending to a shorter, strictly less painful one. That's completely irrational, but consistent with how memory works.
How can we use this knowledge?
For tough processes like performance reviews or medical tests, and gently and predictably. For experiences you want people to repeat, like workshops or meetings, craft a strong final 5 minutes with clear wins and explicit gratitude. Have you ever made a plan to start exercising tomorrow for weeks in a row?
Are you spying on me? That's my specialty.
That's present bias and hyperbolic discounting. Economist David Leibson showed why we happily commit our future selves, but cave when the future becomes now. The math of hyperbolic discounting makes near-term temptations loom huge, while sensible long-term plans collapse at the last minute.
And I'm guessing this gets worse when we're stressed or busy?
Exactly. Sindel Mulanathan and Eldar Shafir call this scarcity tunneling. When we're short on time, money, or bandwidth, we focus on the urgent at the expense of the important. Anyone who has doom-scrolled at midnight while too busy to sleep knows the feeling.
So what's the solution?
Build commitment devices your emotional self can tolerate. Auto-transfers into savings accounts that are hard to access, software that blocks distracting apps after a set time. And try temptation bundling. Pair painful tasks with immediate rewards, like listening to your favorite podcast only when you're at the gym.
We've covered so many fascinating quirks. What are the key takeaways for actually using this knowledge?
I think there are three big patterns. First, structure matters. The choice architecture around you, defaults, progress bars, frictions, silently biases your actions.
If you want better behavior, reshape your environment.
Second, we're storytelling machines. We prefer the familiar to the novel and the persuasive messenger to the perfect message. Being aware of this helps us make better decisions and be more ethical when persuading others.
And third, our neurochemical state, especially dopamine, shapes what feels possible. If your baseline is depleted, work feels joyless. If you're in a scarcity tunnel, long-term thinking collapses.
So the big idea is that most weirdness is actually wisdom optimized for a messy world. Our job isn't to fight it with willpower, it's to design our lives so that our defaults, dopamine, and stories work for us, not against us.
Exactly. And we can start with simple experiments. Audit your defaults, unstack your dopamine hits, craft better endings, and check your explanatory depth before arguing online.
That's your daily dose of smarter from the BeFred podcast. I'm Naya.
And I'm Jackson. If your brain liked this episode, come back tomorrow. We've got more where that came from.